Hello, my name is Racheli Lofglas. Welcome to Torah Imecha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. Today we will be studying Sefer Nehemiah, Perek Yud Gimel, the 13th and final chapter. Yesterday we learned of Nehemiah's huge bash at the Chanukat HaChomot, the sanctification and dedication of the walls of Jerusalem. Nehemiah listed all the important people who paraded into the city on this festification, and people were able to hear that celebration from far away. The men were appointed to keep track of the first fruits and the tithes that were given to the priests and the Levim, and then they performed the service of purification along with the singers and the gatekeepers. Today, as we'll see in this final perek, there are many projects that Nehemiah deals with. For instance, the perek will read almost like Nehemiah's valedictory address. He's going to recap all of his final activities, each of which will echo issues that he had previously grappled with. He's going to go back to Persia, travel back into Persia, and then he's going to come back to Jerusalem only to find out that in his absence, things really did go awry. And then Nehemiah is going to attempt to clean up all that has gone wrong, such as intermarriage, the neglect of those tithes, and the desecration of the Shabbos day. Okay, let's begin. By Yom Ha'u, on that day, which is potentially on the day that they finished sanctifying the walls, or maybe on the day that they instituted the new payroll system, Nikra b'sefer Moshe b'oznei ha'am, they were reading from the Torah of Moshe in front of the people, of another public Torah reading, v'nimtza, and it was found, katupo, that it said, asher lo yavo amonim wa v'bekal elokim ad olam, that you were not allowed to bring in somebody from Ammon and Moab to marry within the Jewish people forever, simply because the Ammonites and the Moabites did not bring the Jewish people bread and water as they were traveling through the Midbar many, many years ago. Vayizkor alav et Bilam, and instead they had hired Bilam to curse Lekalalo, to curse the Jews. Vayathoch Elokeinu HaKalal Rachan, and Hashem ultimately turned the curse of Bilam into a blessing. Vayhi kishamam et haTorah vayavdilu kol erev miYisrael, and as soon as the public Torah reading took place, the Jews who were intermarried separated from their foreign spouses. Okay, so the first thing that the people read in the Torah is that a Jew can't marry an Ammonite and a Moabite, and this actually led the Jews to once again separate from those Gentile wives. Now, if we keep score, actually, this is the third time in the book that intermarriage is even being discussed. The first time was in the last chapter of Ezra, where there was the discovery and a national separation of the nobles from their foreign spouses. Then it was in Nehemiah chapter 10, where there was the Amanah, the national pact. And now here in chapter 13 of Nehemiah, right in the beginning, and then again later on, we'll see at the end of the parak, when Nehemiah is going to return and discover that there's intermarriage happening yet again. So there's a quote here that's almost verbatim from Parshat Balak about not being allowed to marry in to the people of Ammon and Moab. And when the Jewish people hear it right now, they're separating out all whom were married in. But there's a lot here that's actually difficult. First of all, why are we mentioning the book of Moshe? Why not end with Ammon and Moab? Why then mention the curse of Bilam being turned into a blessing? And why are we only mentioning Ammon and Moab foreign spouses and not all the nations who ultimately married in? So the Dat Mikra builds on the Kuzari, which talks about how both Ezra and Nehemiah decided what was most important to include into their respective books. And they decided on the most important with the big highlighted events. And this event meant to be merged back with the public Torah reading back in chapter 8, which was then also called the Torah Moshe, which is why we link the two with the same name. Now remember, as these books are being codified for posterity as part of the 24 books of Tanakh, they have to recognize what the pulse is in terms of the zeitgeist and what going forward is the biggest problem ailing the Jewish people, and that really was intermarriage. So I think we need to learn the next part of the narrative in this chapter in order to then understand what the Malbim will answer to the questions that we posed before, since the first three psukim are really part of what's going to happen going forward now in verses 4 through 9. So Nehemiah is going to now have to respond to an infiltration in the temple. What happens? Verse 4. Before all this, Eliashiv, the high priest, had an office space, so to speak, in the temple, Karov Tovia, close to Tovia. And Vayaslo Lishka Gedola, and Eliashiv, the high priest, made an office or a chamber for Tovia. And that's the same place. That office chamber was a space that beforehand was used to collect all the priestly gifts. Pasuk Vav, verse 6. And while this was taking place, I wasn't even in Jerusalem, tells us Nehemiah. Because in the 32nd year of Artachashasta, Bati El HaMelech, that's when I first arrived to the king on the scene. And now it's time for me to go back. I have to, to the time that I promised the king. So upon returning from a trip to visit with Artaxerxes, Nehemiah learned that Tovia Avia, this idolater who basically has been bothering us the whole Sefer, has been giving an office in the temple, and he is completely outraged, Nechemiah, and he even expels Tovia and right away starts to purify the office, almost like from the germs of Tovia. So what happened, you know, before we discovered what happened, El Yashiv, the Kohen Gadol, was located in this chamber, very, very close proximity. And we're not even sure here if the word Karov means like literally next door of the office or that they're somehow relatives. And both are potential readings because we know that Tovia did marry into the family here. So Pasuk Zayin, V'avol Yerushalayim, I arrived into Yerushalayim, V'avina bara, and I understood this evil that was happening, Asher Asal Yashiv, that El Yashiv did litovia for Tovia, La Solo Nishka, to give him an office, as part of the courtyard of the temple. This was horrible to me, says Nehemiah. And I threw all of his stuff out of the chamber. And I told people, and they cleaned up the chambers. And I put back the right vessels of the temple that were supposed to be in that space, and the frankincense and all the other gifts. Okay, so this story involves a battle against Tovia. From where, if you remember way back into the beginning of our Sefer, Tovia is an Ammonite. In which case, if this is really one story with the beginning of our Perek, it's Nehemiah's second tour now in Jerusalem, and he returns to Jerusalem to find Tovia, so to speak, in charge. Nehemiah's not okay with that. So he reads aloud that Ammon and Moab are not allowed to be part of the people, and in the hopes that the people will really give Tovia the boot, and he won't have to be the bad guy on his own. So when Nehemiah recognizes what happened in his absence on that fateful day, right, by Yom HaHu, as the Perek began, he wants to see who really infiltrated out. Tovia did convert, but someone from Moab is not allowed to marry, someone from Ammon is not allowed to marry in even after a conversion. He has to marry an Ammonite convert, really ad infinitum. So there is some kind of halachic piece, Jewish law piece, that Nehemiah is trying to play into here. Mitzudat David explains that we have to end with the story of Bilam on a positive note, because we don't want the story of this intermarriage ending on a negative note. So it mentions that at the end of this entire story of the intermarriage, it's somebody who was hired to curse us. Ultimately, his curse turned into a blessing. So remember, Tovia was really a bad Ammonite. He was part of that group looking to assassinate Nehemiah earlier on, and or at least lure him out of the city. And that's why Nehemiah is so vehement in taking care of this issue. So the major piece for Nehemiah, as he restored the gift-giving, processions back in the land and the financial security of the tithes and the taxes, he made this big Torah reading now, not random, but because he wanted everybody to show that Ammon cannot be included. And he tried to get the people to rally against Tovia. Obviously, he's personally affronted and angered, and therefore he personally gathered Tovia's stumps that kind of just dumps it everywhere. But we never assumed Tovia even got the tithes of the other Levium, just the office space. Although it's interesting that Ibn Ezra does believe that in getting the office, he also got the tithes that went with that office. But too much of having an office space smack in the middle of the temple gives Tovia standing with the Jews and essentially with the Persians that Nehemiah is looking very harshly to stay away from. Interesting also in verse number 7, where it says, Va'avina, and I understood. Nehemiah is letting us know that when he heard of Tovia's temple office, he had to analyze it. And that word is actually consistent with the use of this word throughout other contexts in the Sefer, and actually throughout Ezra Nehemiah, which is consistent to the larger migration in the new culture of Shivat Zion of this time period towards really scholarly and sophisticated political Jewish leadership, not just following, what the prophets call are. Okay, so verses 10 to 13 talks about reinstating tithes. The Edak Kiminayot Elavimnona, I found out that the portions were not being given, and the people were running to their fields of the Levium and of the singers and all the workers of the temple. And I fought with the people and I said, why are you abandoning your job in the temple? And I gathered all of them and I put them back on their stands to do their work. Okay, so Nehemiah seems to hear that the Levium have not been receiving their tithes while he was out of town. And fuming, he castigates the leadership and he tries very hard to rectify the situation. But the odd word in verse 10, vayivrchu, is that they run. So are they running away from something or towards something? So Rashi seems to think that the Levium are fleeing to seek their gifts in the fields of others in these tribally apportioned cities. Otherwise, the Levium are going to be left with nothing if they don't run to pick it up somewhere. And they need to do their work. So they're running away in order to try to gather sustenance for themselves. Mitzudat David said each of the Levium are fleeing to their own fields to work and sustain themselves and their family. That if nobody is overseeing the donations to the Levium, then the Levium are going to be left literally hungry. So essentially, it looks like they were becoming farmers. And that's what Yevayi Vrchu means, that they ran away. So we see the theme, not on the emphasis of work or collection, but on the abandonment of the temple, which seems to be what they're fleeing from with due reason, but it's still they're running away. And this is not the first time Nehemiah complains of Mikdash abandonment. And he also insists on taking people with credibility, and talking to them and trying to get them to rectify the situation. In the very next section of the parak, we're going to again see that there's self-congratulation for restoration of the Mikdash. In verse 14, Nehemiah says, "Zachra li Elokai alzot v'al temach hasadai asher asiti b'vayt Elokai b'mishrav." Hashem, please remember me for the good and don't erase all the compassionate things and the projects that I did in the temple and in making sure that there were guard shifts. So again, we note that Nehemiah turns to somehow prayer for the nation, like we saw back in chapter 5, and he's asking for like a defense against detractors. But most importantly, Nehemiah is letting us know that he did not capitulate to whatever else was going on. And essentially in congratulating himself, just like he did back in chapter 5 when he took care of all the loans of the indentured servants, we're not talking about, you know, what we're talking about is a demolition here of his amanah, of the constitution, but he's letting us know that he did not give in, that he came back to Jerusalem now after a hiatus back at Persia, and he saw things needed to be reestablished, and he doesn't wait to do that. He takes care of it right away. Next, we move on to Nehemiah's protection of the Shabbos day, verses Tatvav to Chavbet, 15 to 22. I saw when I in those days that the Jews were treading on the wine presses b'Shabbat on the Shabbos day, and they were carrying piles of their wares and they were saddling it onto their donkeys, and wine and grapes and figs and all their wares they were bringing into Jerusalem on Shabbos. And I warned them on that day that they were selling their wares. So when Nehemiah observed that the people are treading or trampling on the wine presses and engaging in all this commercial activity on Shabbos, which is really biblically prohibited, right? Dash and Schita, you know, the threshing on the wine presses. This is not a rabbinic problem, according to some, and he's irate. This is biblical. They're also bringing piles of grapes and loading them on their donkeys and their figs. Interesting, there's an Oxford comma issue here. Is this wine from figs or wine plus figs? But I digress. And they bring it to Jerusalem on Shabbos, and Nehemiah doesn't know what to do with them. The Hatzarim Yoshvu Ba Bivim Dag V'chol Mecher Machrim B'Shabbat Lefnei Yehudi B'Shalayim. So the people, basically, of Tyre up north in Lebanon are the sea merchants from Phoenicia. They're sitting in Jerusalem and they're buying fish and other goods to sell in Jerusalem to the Judeans. And Jerusalem is mentioned twice here, even though it's obvious that we're talking about, because it's the point of Jerusalem being of all places, the places where they're desecrating the Shabbos, and Nehemiah will not have it. So if we summarize, the Malbim says that there were really three levels of activity here. There's the biblical prohibition of threshing on Shabbat. Then there's the not allowing animals to rest on Shabbat, which is a problem. And the rabbinic prohibition of sales and recording of those sales on Shabbos. Pasuk Yud Zayin 17, Va'ariv et Chorei Yehuda, and I fought with the people. He's picking on the leaders. And I said to them, Ma hadavar hazeh ater Hashem osim u'mechal min Shabbat? What are you doing, basically? So Nehemiah tells the leaders, shape up. He never would have believed that the leaders were too big to fail or too big to take on. He puts them then essentially in charge of the gates, and the Rabbag is going to have a practical religious point here. The problem is that Shabbos up until this point is not really recognizable in the temple. What did Shabbos look like in those days? This way they have a Shabbos now also in the Mikdash, which can have, you know, can then be noticed among the temple workers. So maybe it was good to see that Levium had a broader educational role in the community now and not just a traditional function. What does he tell them to do? He says to them in verse 18 that this is exactly the problem that we had before with our ancestors of not keeping Shabbos. You're adding to these issues by desecrating the Shabbos. So when he confronts the Judean nobles, Nehemiah is warning them on the day that they sell these goods that you are continuing in the ways of your forefathers who were punished precisely for this kind of sinful behavior. And he warns them that desecration of Shabbos and the consequences of it is really an anger that you don't want God to have against Israel. So what does he do? He says this will not be. In verse number 19, he said that whenever the sunset starts to cast a shadow over the gates of the city, that's when you know you need to close the gates of the city on Erev Shabbat, right before Shabbat. And you wouldn't be able to open it until Saturday night. And he put workers there to guard the gates, to make sure that wares were not being brought in and out of the city. So Rashi explains that when the shadow of the Sabbath Eve fell on the gates, he ordered the doors of the city to be closed and not reopened until after Shabbos, so that the traffickers would not enter the city to sell their merchandise and cause Israel to really profane the day of Shabbos. So what happens? So these peddlers kind of waited outside all Shabbos, hoping people will come out and buy, or the gates will open somehow. And this continued to happen for a few Shabboses. Pasuk Aleph and Chavet, then things start to change. And then Nehemiah tells them, what are you leaning against the doors of the wall for? I'm not going to help you here. So he exits the doors, Nehemiah, and he yells at the peddlers, what are you hanging out here? If you do it again, you're big trouble. So he then tells the Levium in verse 22 to purify themselves and come guard the gates. And he ends up remedying the situation by stationing them outside, ensuring that these gates stay closed for the duration of the day of Shabbos. And then ultimately he says, Gamzo tzachra lokai v'chusalai kirov chasach Hashem, remember me again for good. So a few key notes here. Interesting that from the history of halacha perspective, there's a Mishnah that discusses mukta, the idea of things that are not allowed on Shabbos. And there are items that are set aside before Shabbos that we're not allowed to use. These items came across and then we didn't use them at all. So you're not allowed to handle certain things on Shabbos. And Nehemiah enacted this here because they were transporting goods on Shabbos, and moving them is not really an issue. That's touching them is an issue. And he was trying to basically create these boundaries so that they don't come to do things that are biblically problematic. Verses Chav Gimel to Chav Chet, 23 to 28, there's an encountering, a further encountering of intermarriage. I see in those days that the men again took back women of Ashdod and Ammon and Moab. And the next generation of kids, they kind of speak Hebrew and they kind of speak Ashdodit, and they don't really understand the difference of the speech, and they're not good with their own mother tongue that should be Hebrew. And I yelled at them and I cursed them and I said to them, if you allow your sons and your daughters to intermarry, these are the sins that Shlomo HaMelech did. And there was nobody as great as Shlomo, and shame on you for doing in these sins. And even Hashem made the sins of Shlomo and his intermarriage have dire consequences. So what do you think is going to happen to you? Pasuk Chav Zayin, v'lachem hanishma lasot et kol ra hagdola azot limol, and you think you're going to get away with these terrible debacles with religious observance? Lahoshiv nashim rachrit, by keeping your foreign wives? U'mibnei Yehoyada ben Eliashiv HaKoyen HaGadol, chatan l'sambara l'choroni v'avrichei omela. And then we find out in verse 28 that even Sanballat somehow is married within the temple families. So Nehemiah forcibly separates the men from their foreign wives, and he tells them that the nations might not be as they're listed because they're all scrambled. And if the kids of these marriages can't speak any type of let's call it Yiddish of the time, right, but it's a blend of other languages, then we have a problem going forward to know really who's who and what the culture is. He actually mentioned Shlomo HaMelech almost out of nowhere, because Shlomo even was deceived by foreign women, and he was the smartest man that ever lived. And he mentions the sin against God here that Shlomo did by having these non-Jewish wives, and then he kicks out someone who was amongst the son-in-laws of the descendants of the Kohen Gadol. He really just gets rid of him. And then, of course, as required always by Nehemiah, he tells God, remember me for the good. So what is the good here that he's referring to? So there's an argument here between the Eben Ezra and the Metudat David. The Eben Ezra says the good that he did here is that he kicked out the non-Jewish wives and he wants to be rewarded. And that also that they kicked out the people from the priestly service that didn't deserve to be there because of their intermarriage. Or according to Metudat David, he's saying, remember us for the bad and punish them. Remember me, punish the people who were desecrating your laws and were intermarrying. So Nehemiah's violent response of cursing the people here, there really isn't a precedent for it. But this idea of putting them in excommunication and swearing not to engage in these marriages ever again, you know, it's a big deal. And Zakheim in his book says that Nehemiah didn't kill them, and that counts for something. But since he perceives this as very, very terrible, even a political threat to the future of the Jews, he has to be anything but, you know, he has to be very, very harsh. Nehemiah doesn't talk about the evil of intermarriage per se. Marriage, he seems to say that is fine, seemingly, but it seems to lead men astray. By mentioning Shlomo HaMelech, that's what he's saying. So that it's rabbinically prohibited because of that. And Ammon and Moab are biblical prohibition, so they really went above and beyond. I think the big deal that Nehemiah has here on an emphasis of the language knowledge, it's because of their cohesion as a community. You know, too many different synagogues and shuls and schools develop if you don't have like one unified community and language. Also, the invocation here of King Shlomo is very interesting because Shlomo really represents to the Jewish people our apex of Jewish history and our successes, really the height of Tanakh to the world. Even the Queen of Sheba, when she came to visit Shlomo HaMelech, praised Hashem, and then it all collapsed. And Nehemiah kind of wants to recapture the zenith of Shlomo. And I guess that's why there's like a weird left turn here to discuss King Shlomo, because Nehemiah is grabbing a representation of everything he had dreamed of achieving and in the hopes of it not failing. The last three verses of the Perek, or of the Sefer actually, Nehemiah establishes these set rotations for temple services, word sacrifices, and bringing of the first fruit. And then, of course, there's self-congratulation for restoring that work. Zachra lehem Elokai al Gali. Hashem, remember that the defilers of the priestly world, the Tiharta Mikol Nechar, and that we restore them of their foreign people, the Amida Mishmarot, and I place them with shifts and guard duty, the Kohanim, Vale Levim, Ish Melachton, and I made sure their work was not abandoned, Ule Korban Haitzim, and for the wood sacrifices, Beitim Mizumanot, all the appropriate time that they had to deliver the wood, Vale Bikrim, and the first fruits, Zachar Le Lokai Lo Tova, Hashem, please remember me for good. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Tzadi Gimel tells us that the book of Nehemiah is not titled after him for really two reasons. It's really called Ezra. Ezra and Nehemiah together are considered the book of Ezra. So why is that? Reason number one is Mipnei Shehechazik Tova La'atzmo, that Nehemiah seems to constantly try to fetch compassion and reward for himself, as opposed to thinking about this much more inclusively. And reason number two, Mipnei Shesiper Bignutan Shel Rishonim, that earlier on, Nehemiah kind of denigrated previous governors to his own governorship in the hopes of making himself look better. So, you know, it's hard to see this reality that potentially some of this arrogance spills over and he loses the name after him. But I guess, you know, absolute power sometimes corrupts. And Nehemiah, though he did so much to benefit the people, he still struggles with this issue. There's a significant emphasis on purity in this last chapter, sometimes not even in connection with the temple. And along those lines, in an effort to preserve the Kedusha, the sanctity of Shabbos, the Levim are summoned to guard the gates of the temple. Not the gates of the temple, but of Jerusalem, right? The outside of the temple. And this refashioning of traditional categories really confirms the shifting emphasis in Jewish life at the close of this memoir of Nehemiah. I think it's also interesting that in emphasizing the ancestors' sins and consequences, Nehemiah is really paralleling the Navi Zechariah, who, when he opened his own book, told us that we should never continue in the sinful behaviors of our forefathers. And if we take a step back, we will observe that Nehemiah's last chapter really brings his story full circle. Just as at the beginning of the Sefer, he is elsewhere, and then he arrives on the scene with really decisive action, here also, he arrives on the scene, acts decisively regarding the purity of the temple offices. And at the same time, the difference between the events of the first chapter of Nehemiah and this last chapter really capture the enormity of Nehemiah's achievements. At the very beginning of the book, there is this existential crisis. The walls of Jerusalem are burnt. The community's survival is far from assured. But now, by the Sefer's end, the wall was completed. The community's safety is secure. And Nehemiah now turns his attention to matters of ethics like the tithes and the mikdash and religious practices like Shabbat and intermarriage. Yet, Chazal really do critique Nehemiah for inappropriately trumpeting his own actions and making fun or putting down past leaders. And, you know, that's, you know, how he touches upon a look for recognition. He, you know, he does bring himself down a bit. And I think this really leads us to a novel understanding of the rabbinic critique of Nehemiah. Yirmiyahu, who lived, you know, maybe two centuries before Nehemiah, was the most reviled of prophets, and he spent most of his time, you know, a lot of his time, not most of his time, but a lot of his time chastising the lack of Shabbat observance. And Nehemiah now is suggesting that, like Yirmiyahu, he also endured tremendous sacrifices in pressing the people to be more obedient with regards to keeping religious law. But the rabbis really view Nehemiah's comparison to Yirmiyahu, even subliminally, they view it very unfavorably. Even though they may have felt that there was no room for comparison, as Yirmiyahu suffered so much worse than Nehemiah, Nehemiah's mission wasn't just to critique the people for their shortcomings. He needed to move them in a positive direction. And constantly bringing the you know, the search for reward on to himself doesn't play a good message. And although while the, you know, the rabbis do critique him, it's not textually obvious when we read just, you know, the literal translation of the book. There's really no hint in the text that Nehemiah was censored. They just seem to be picking up on this important motif that he keeps saying, you know, God, remember me for the good, remember me for the good. So despite Nehemiah's stunning successes, if this final parak is any indication, Nehemiah's ultimate legacy is really ambiguous. It is not clear to us what extent he really was successful to address intermarriage or purity, Shabbat observance, the tithes, or any work in the Mikdash. And his call for recognition, at least in our parak where it's mentioned so many times, seems potentially to mask what could be understood as limited success. And given Nehemiah's really remarkable achievements at the earlier stages in his book, this is remarkable because for all of his accomplishments and efforts in securing the people's safety and taking away their vulnerability and teaching them how to stand up against hooligans and to trust in Hashem and to have faith and to turn to him and to daven, Nehemiah's sefer really concludes with his work seemingly incomplete. So I think that's, you know, that idea is something really to take into account. Thank you so much for studying Sefer Nehemiah together. Le'iloi Nishmas, Malka Esther, Batzvi Yosef.